From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Consumer activist Ralph Nader isn't calling the tobacco pact historic. He says it's a corporate ripoff.
And if the worst industry, presumably the addictive industry of all time, gets this privilege and immunity from Congress, what about other industries coming up who want to get out of court cases? And they can go to Congress and say, hey, you gave it to the tobacco companies, and they're supposed to be the worst. Why don't you give it to us?
A Somali child roasted on an open fire, sexual exploitation, torture, and murder, just some of the charges against UN peacekeepers in Somalia. Then this weekend, tens of thousands of union activists rallied in Detroit in support of the striking newspaper workers.
We understood that we had to walk away from the jobs we loved with our backs straight and our heads held high. And we did.
Hear this, Knight Ridder and Gannett. You're corporate outlaws, and we'll treat you like criminals.
And the G8 summit finished up in Denver. We'll talk with members of the other economic summit. Yep, 5,000 people went to Denver this weekend to critique the G8. I bet you didn't hear about it in the national media. Well, you'll hear about it here. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Western European leaders reacted angrily yesterday after failing to persuade the United States and Japan to adopt explicit targets for the reduction of greenhouse gases. The European Union wanted other participants at the Summit of Eight Heads of Government in Denver, Colorado, known as the G8, to endorse its self-imposed target to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, mainly caused by burning fossil fuels, to 15% below their 1990 levels by the year 2010. But President Bill Clinton blocked attempts to make this commitment in the communique issued at the end of the summit. After meeting with mayors around the country today, he'll head to the United Nations to talk about the environment. Facing continued white resistance to busing to achieve school desegregation, an increasingly conservative judiciary, and now criticism from inside and outside its ranks, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People is rethinking one of its fundamental principles, advocacy of public school integration. The NAACP has always supported school integration as a way to improve educational opportunities for black students, but other black leaders have begun voicing doubts about that goal. They say the organization should focus more heavily on seeking the improvement of majority black schools. A change in the 88-year-old organization's position on school integration, should it occur, would come after years of criticism of the NAACP as being hidebound and lacking in appeal for younger blacks. Debating such a radical move would allow the organization to be seen as being more attuned to new thinking in civil rights. The debate is expected to take place at the national meeting. This in the New York Times today, the changes in federal tax and benefit policies now working their way through Congress would eventually be worth thousands of dollars a year to the 5 million wealthiest families in America, while the 40 million families with the lowest incomes would actually lose money. This, according to a new study, the effect would be to widen the gap between the richest and poorest families, a division that has been growing for the past 20 years. The findings by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a Washington research institute whose statistical studies are generally respected in academic circles, indicate that the after-tax income of the richest 1% of Americans, those with incomes above about $300,000 a year for a family of three, would ultimately be an increase by an average of $27,000 a year. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Tobacco negotiators announced on Friday a settlement which, if ratified, promises to change the way cigarettes are marketed in the United States, to provide billions of dollars in compensation to states, and to permanently alter the nation's legal, regulatory, and public health landscape. The complex agreement, negotiated by a group of state attorneys general, plaintiffs' lawyers, and industry representatives, would require cigarette companies to pay $368 billion over the next 25 years to compensate states for the costs of treating smoking-related illness, to finance nationwide anti-smoking programs, and to underwrite health care for millions of uninsured children. Under terms of the proposed settlement, the tobacco industry would admit for the first time in prominent new warning labels on every package of cigarettes that smoking is lethal and addictive. The plan imposes strict new limits on tobacco marketing and advertising, including a ban on vending machines and outdoor billboards. Right now, we're joined by consumer activist and former Green presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Well, Ralph, what do you think of this agreement?
Well, the tobacco companies got four things that they wanted, which was not widely reported. One, they wanted immunity from further lawsuits. These are the lawsuits that got the internal documents, incriminating evidence out to the public, to the FDA, to Congressman Henry Waxman's committee, to 60 Minutes, Prime Time, the newspapers, and got the whole process going. They got immunity from these lawsuits. No more class actions, no more consolidation of cases. Individual cases can still be brought, but that is extremely expensive to do. Second, they got an open season on the Congress and the FDA, which have to, A, approve the agreement in terms of the Congress and issue regulations restricting nicotine and other dangerous substances in tobacco. The tobacco company's lobbyists can weaken the agreement on Capitol Hill with their many friends, including Newt Gingrich and Trent Lott, the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader, who already have spoken against parts of this agreement. And their lawyers can delay and obstruct for years any proposals by the Food and Drug Administration. Third, they got a compensation package, which in today's dollars is so modest and so easy to live with that Wall Street has raised the value of tobacco company shares by about 20% in the last few weeks. And fourth, they got a free hand to continue expanding with no restrictions their markets overseas on their way to hooking hundreds of millions of youngsters in Asia, Africa, South America, and Eastern Europe. They got these four objectives, and in that sense, they prevailed.
Now, of course, this isn't done because Congress has to sign off on it.
Yes, they prevailed in the sense of their agreement with several state attorney generals. There are still some state attorneys general who are objecting, who are going to pursue their own lawsuits, most notably State Attorney General Humphrey from Minnesota.
It's interesting you mentioned Trent Lott, because I just saw him on the Sunday shows saying that he will recuse himself from the congressional consideration of this proposal because his brother-in-law is one of the lawyers. I assume that means tobacco lawyers.
Well, that's quite interesting. That's very rarely done. Just a few days ago, he expressed severe reservations about giving the Food and Drug Administration statutory authority. One of the aspects of this proposed settlement by the attorney generals and the tobacco companies would actually give the Food and Drug Administration authority over nicotine that they now have and make the Food and Drug Administration wait a dozen years before they can eliminate nicotine from cigarettes, which, of course, is less authority than the Food and Drug Administration has now.
On that point of the FDA, the Times says it gives the Food and Drug Administration new powers to regulate nicotine as a drug and cigarettes as drug delivery devices. But as you've expressed, David Kessler, the former head of the FDA, has grave reservations about this, and he's been appointed as co-chair of the committee that will advise Congress on this proposal. Explain why you think this actually limits the FDA authority when the standard wisdom of the last few days says that it's going to allow the FDA to go forward on regulating nicotine as a drug.
Well, right now, the FDA has authority to regulate tobacco after a federal district court decision in North Carolina. They have authority to regulate tobacco, and it's open-ended except for advertising. And, of course, the regulation of tobacco company advertising is the province now of the Federal Trade Commission, not the Food and Drug Administration. But in this agreement, and we will see the fine print when they release the larger details of this agreement between state attorney generals and the tobacco companies, there are requirements that the FDA can issue certain regulations if there is substantial likelihood that it will reduce smoking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are requirements that the FDA is not under at the present time. And, of course, the tobacco companies still have powerful friends on Capitol Hill.
Let's talk about the issue of liability for a minute, the class action suits versus the individual lawsuits, and also bringing in the international aspect of this. A few days ago on Democracy Now!, we spoke with some top anti-smoking activists in Hong Kong, in South Africa, and Canada, and they were very concerned that while this is being called a global agreement, they were not involved with these negotiations. And I think it also has something to do with this whole issue of class action and individual lawsuits. Some will say, here you are, Ralph Nader, a lawyer yourself, support by trial lawyers. Of course, you're not happy with this. Explain what liability is being limited and why this hurts individuals.
Well, first of all, the trial lawyers who are part of this agreement are very happy with this agreement. So there is a difference of opinion between me and trial lawyers on this subject. Second, remember, none of this would have happened without the civil justice system, the tort law system. The early and recent litigation against the tobacco companies by a handful of lawyers who slowly started to pry out of the secret files of the tobacco companies the incriminating evidence that they lied, they covered up, they knew nicotine was addictive, they had research for safer cigarettes that they didn't want to disclose. So naturally, the source of all of this pressure on the tobacco companies, the courts of law in our country, was the objective of the tobacco companies during the settlement to make sure it doesn't happen again. It simply is not economic to bring a single lawsuit by a single plaintiff against the tobacco companies. One trial lawyer told me the other day, if someone walked into his office and gave him $1 million of expenses, he couldn't afford to bring a single case against the tobacco companies. That's what the tobacco companies achieved in their settlement with the state's attorney generals. They got rid of class actions. They got rid of consolidation of cases, which means that if a pair of twins was addicted and at age 12 and sued the tobacco companies at age 60, they couldn't even consolidate their cases. They have to proceed independently. So that's the real tragedy. The first industry, if this deal goes through Congress and is signed by Clinton, to get this kind of broad-based immunity from litigation, from the tort system, and if the worst industry, presumably the addictive industry of all time, gets this privilege and immunity from Congress, what about other industries coming up who want to get out of court cases? And they can go to Congress and say, hey, you gave it to the tobacco companies, and they're supposed to be the worst. Why don't you give it to us? The asbestos industry could have tried this. In fact, at one point they wanted to, but they didn't get it from Congress. It's a very bad precedent.
It also says that the money that the tobacco companies will pay out every year is tax deductible.
Yes, except for the punitive damage portion, which is about $50 billion spread over time. Most of it is tax deductible. This means that it's 34% less. This means that while the tobacco companies are replenishing some of the state Medicaid money, they are depleting some of the U.S. Treasury money. So the taxpayer shares in this settlement. The least the state attorney generals should have done was to get them to agree that it's not tax deductible, but it is. But in real present-day dollars, $368 billion spread over 25 years is about $120 billion. It is so manageable that when Wall Street heard about it, they pushed the price of tobacco company shares like Philip Morris up, because this has been rumored now for several weeks. So it's a very manageable deal for the tobacco companies. Yet the press, of course, was drawn to the grab bag lists of marketing, advertising restrictions, etc., many of which were already on their way, a few of which were already in place, affecting youth access, etc., and most of them are not going to make that much of a difference, however good they sound in practice. The tobacco cessation programs will do some good, but that's certainly something that the government could have done without the settlement and should have done. The public health parties to this agreement, led by Matt Myers, including the American Cancer Society and the American Heart Association, must tell the public whether they are going to accept any of the funds from this settlement for their tobacco control work, because if they are, they are in a conflict of interest in signing on to this deal.
Finally, Ralph Nader, is this going to be your next big battle? Are you going to take this on now as Congress considers this and fight against it?
Yes. We've been opposing the tobacco companies since the early 70s or even late 60s when we broke through on separation of smoking, non-smoking passengers on airlines and interstate buses. This is an industry that is extremely clever at allowing concessions that don't mean all that much while proceeding to more and more profits. I think this proposed deal has an essential immoral code, immoral part to it, because it doesn't apply to overseas. It doesn't affect the biggest and most booming portion of the U.S. tobacco companies' markets in continents overseas. And that is its greatest flaw. What should have been done was to require the tobacco companies to agree that any concessions they make in the United States, they have to offer to all countries around the world. And that was not done.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Ralph Nader, consumer activist and former Green presidential candidate. By the way, President Clinton says that he is encouraged critics of the historic tobacco agreement announced on Friday to regard it as a starting point, that he's encouraging them to regard it as a starting point rather than as a finished product, and said he himself fears that it might hobble the government's regulation of nicotine. But Clinton said he was pleased with the reception even the critics of the proposed settlement had given it. We'll see how pleased he is with Ralph Nader's comments and with the kind of pressure that's going to be brought to bear on Congress as they debate this pact. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're going to try to begin our next segment a little early before the break because we have so much to do, having followed this very busy weekend from Denver. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the other economic summit, and we want to go to Detroit as well because 100,000 people rallied in support of the striking newspaper workers. But right now, I want to talk about another issue, and it involves the United Nations. The head of the Somali community in Italy has asked the UN Secretary General to launch an inquiry into allegations that Rome's troops in Somalia engaged in torture and rape. The allegations, based on photographs and interviews with Italian soldiers who served in Somalia as part of a multinational force from late 92 to early 94, have been published over the past few weeks in the news magazine Panorama. Meanwhile, two UN soldiers from Belgium are expected to stand trial this week in their own country on charges of roasting a live Somali child over an open fire during peacekeeping operations in 1993. A third Belgian soldier will also stand trial for forcing another Somali child to drink saltwater vomit and worms. Photos taken by one Belgian UN soldier, published for what's probably the first time in the United States by the Village Voice, show two soldiers smiling as they roast one child. Another soldier photographed forcing this child to drink the worms and vomit after being compelled to drink salt water to make him vomit. Right now, we're joined by Jennifer Gould, who is the reporter who did this piece in the Village Voice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to be with you. Tell us a little more about this. We're going to go to a break in about 60 seconds, and then we'll talk more extensively afterwards. But how did you get these pictures and find out about this story?
The pictures were taken by another UN soldier who was down there, and the pictures only came to light when he became concerned that those very soldiers were working in another peacekeeping operation still in Africa. It's part of a large pattern of torture and murder and sexual exploitation of children by UN peacekeepers, and the story explores those abuses as well as general allegations of corruption and mismanagement of more than $26 million in Rwanda and millions of dollars in Somalia.
Jennifer,
so
we'll break.
So the story looks at all of this.
Jennifer, we'll break and then come back to look at what exactly the soldiers are being charged with and what the UN is doing about this. Jennifer Gould, who did this week's story in the Village Voice called Tortured by UN Peacekeepers. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Jennifer Gould. She's author of this week's piece in the Village Voice called Tortured by UN Peacekeepers, United Nations Soldiers Accused of Sexual Exploitation, Torture, and Murder of Children. We had her on a few weeks ago when she did the first in a series on the UN. You may remember that was the piece she did on sexual harassment at United Nations headquarters and also talked about some of the UN peacekeeping missions. Jennifer's also author of the new book, Vodka Tears and Lenin's Angel, which covers her experiences as a journalist in the former Soviet Union. She's just returned from there. Well, let's continue on this issue, this follow-up piece that you have done about UN peacekeepers and the reaction of the United Nations now that some of this information is coming out on the Italian soldiers, the UN peacekeepers, as well as the Belgian soldiers and what they did in Somalia.
I mean, the reaction so far has been basically minimal. It's incredibly surprising. The day after my piece ran in the Village Voice, the New York Post ran the same photo and did a follow-up story with UN officials saying they were stunned by these photos. Well, the photos, the knowledge of these activities have been around for a long time. What I write in the story is one UN official says that the UN doesn't even say usually which soldiers from what countries have committed abuses because, quote, they're not in the habit of embarrassing troop-contributing governments. So there's a real policy of secrecy that means that abuses don't get out unless somehow they're leaked to the press, and even then they're usually hushed up. And so what's really difficult is to follow the pattern, to find out what happens once these abuses have been committed.
The Belgian peacekeepers, I mean, it's hard to call them peacekeepers, of course, but the Belgian soldiers who are on the cover of the Village Voice in a full-page picture roasting this child over this open fire, they're grinning. As you said, another Belgian soldier took their photograph. What are they being charged with?
They're not being charged with a very serious crime at all. It's like a crime committing physical injury, but it's not very serious. If they are convicted of this, it's going to be a very light sentence. And that's been the pattern. The most time a soldier has paid for torture and murder in the UN, as far as I have been able to tell, is a Canadian peacekeeper who spent 2 years in jail, just 2 years of a five-year sentence, after one young Somali teenager was tortured and murdered by Canadian peacekeepers, who then also photographed themselves grinning beside this bound and mutilated corpse. So
That was a picture that we did see a few years ago, right? That was a picture that went around the world. A horrendous story.
So the charges so far that UN peacekeepers face are not big at all. What the UN does do, what I did was I traced different abuses that UN peacekeepers had been accused of and charged with in different operations. And it ranges from everything from torture and murder to sexual exploitation to arms and drugs, drug running, and lesser crimes. And basically what the UN will do is repatriate soldiers, send them back to their home countries. But after that, it's very difficult to trace what happens. In Mozambique, some Italian peacekeepers were sent home after there were charges of prostitution with young girls. But in other countries, there was charges in the former Yugoslavia where UN peacekeepers from many different countries were having sex with captives, you know, Muslim women and Croatian women in a Serbian brothel, and nothing ever came of that. So if we don't know where the soldiers are from, we can't really check what happens once they're sent home, and the UN is extremely reluctant to give out this kind of information.
We're talking to Jennifer Gould, who did the cover story of the Village Voice on UN peacekeepers from places like Belgium, Canada, Italy. Have U.S. soldiers been implicated in this?
Not in charges of outright torture and murder, no. There were a lot of abuses, though. And what we see, what happens, for example, in Belgium, also just because some UN peacekeepers are involved in these horrifying crimes, of course, there are many that are doing a lot of good, and a lot of innocent peacekeepers have been killed overseas while trying to keep peace in other countries. One of the big problems in Rwanda, 10 Belgian peacekeepers were murdered by locals there. And if you don't understand the context of that, once you do understand the context, things change, because before those peacekeepers were murdered, there were allegations of torture and abuse of local citizens. So, you know, abuses by some peacekeepers not only obviously endangers locals, but it endangers their colleagues as well. So it's something that, you know, in Somalia had been going on all over the place. It was just rampant. And so it's just so surprising that the UN would say they're stunned by these photos or by this knowledge. There are some UN peacekeepers who say that in the Italian troops, for example, they were filled with white supremacists who, you know, made the Mussolini fascist salute in Somalia. There was a UN civilian who left $3.9 million in an unlocked filing cabinet. And surprise of surprise, as the money disappears, the UN fires him. But what typically happens, I traced what happened to this man. He appealed, he was exonerated, and then the UN rehired him to be a security consultant in Liberia for them. So following through when abuses occur, it's really outrageous. The most the UN has done so far is to issue a card that each peacekeeper carries that we printed in the Village Voice that says things like, you know, don't torture or sexually exploit people. And carrying a little card is just not enough.
Now, this card, these enhanced code of conduct guidelines were first issued in Mozambique, is that right, after a UN child sex scandal? What exactly happened there?
We still don't know what happened. What usually happens in these situations is that if there is a UN inquiry, it is kept confidential so that the public or the press can't have access. I tried to see what was in that inquiry in that report. I couldn't. There was one independent report that I did see, and all that it said was that there were some Italian peacekeepers who were repatriated because of sexual exploitation of young children in Mozambique. We don't know how many peacekeepers, and we don't know how many children. There were other allegations also. We also don't know what happened to those peacekeepers, but they are believed to have been repatriated without any punishment whatsoever.
It's also interesting, you point out in your piece that the head of the UN operation in Mozambique, Aldo Agiello of Portugal, is now European envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa.
Right. And what usually happens in these situations, what I found, is that someone who was in charge of one peacekeeping mission, if there was a scandal, he might be moved to another peacekeeping mission. One man was in charge of a mission in Cambodia. There were a lot of scandals there, and he went on to head the mission in the former Yugoslavia. A lot of things happened there. Abuse of authority. And from there, people end up back in high positions of authority within the UN in New York. So that it seems as if the UN actually rewards people who are in charge of missions where abuses occur instead of punishing them. There are some groups now like UNICEF and UNHCR which have actually made recommendations to try to stop a lot of these abuses. One of the things they want is an ombudsman or ombudsperson in each peacekeeping operation with the sole reason that they need to have somebody who is responsible for abuses.
right now in Italy, apparently, even though they did open an investigation a year or two ago into the allegations of what happened in Somalia with Italian troops, they're opening new inquiries into the allegations. And these inquiries have prompted the resignation of the commanding officers of the Italian force in Somalia. So for some reason, this time, this is taking hold, perhaps because of the Italian peacekeeping mission that's supposed to be in Albania for the elections June 29th.
Well, I think what is really happening is that there's a photograph, and the same thing happened in Belgium. There were allegations raised in Belgium a few years ago also, but they were dismissed, and the people who were in charge of that unit said that the charges were exaggerated and it wasn't as bad as it seemed. But now we have pictures of the torture by Italian peacekeepers and by the torture of the Belgian peacekeepers. And with that, that evidence is so indisputable that these, you know, inquiries, commissions are reopening. And I think that's a big part of it. And you're right that one of the reasons why these photographs are resurfacing is because some people are very concerned that these soldiers who are alleged to have tortured and murdered people in Somalia are now back in peacekeeping operations, that there were some Belgians still in Rwanda, and there are the Italians heading for the first time a multinational operation in Albania.
Jennifer Gould, last question. That is, are there any grassroots groups that are forming or currently existing that are taking on this issue and pushing the UN to hold these peacekeepers accountable or end the peacekeeping operations?
Well, that's an interesting question. I haven't come across any group that really has been. What I've found are a lot of people within the UN who at first were really terrified to speak for losing their jobs, for fear of losing their jobs, but very horrified by these abuses and wanting them to come out. And since the article has appeared, I've gotten a lot of calls from concerned readers. You know, what can they do? How can they stop these abuses? You know, the best thing is to letter writing campaigns, but there really, so far as I know, isn't one group that's in charge of doing anything like this. But the point also is not that, you know, the UN is bad or all peacekeeping missions are bad, but that there are abuses and there should be ways to maintain peacekeeping, but without the abuse.
Jennifer Gould, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Her latest piece is the cover story of The Village Voice, Tortured by UN Peacekeepers, United Nations Soldiers Accused of Sexual Exploitation, Torture, and Murder of Children. You can get The Village Voice, or you can go to the World Wide Web at www.villagevoice.com. Jennifer is also the author of new book, Vodka Tears and Lenin's Angel, which covers her experiences as a journalist in the former Soviet Union from 1992 to 1996, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. Well, thanks for your good reporting, Jennifer.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Amy.
Right now, we're going to turn to another subject before we go out to Denver to talk about the other economic summit that took place there this weekend. We're going to go to Detroit, where more than 100,000 people gathered in support of the striking
Amanda
newspaper
Davis,
workers.
Who's a locked-out worker with Newspaper Guild Local 22. On July 13, 1995, a curious thing happened here in Detroit. We understood that we had to walk away from the jobs we loved with our backs straight and our heads held high. And we did. And when we did, the walls came tumbling down. And then we asked you to come to Sterling Heights to be with us to stare down the goons, and you came. And you asked us to come to Watsonville to show California's strawberry barons our collective strength, and we did. And from Boston to Miami, and from Washington, D.C. to Puerto Rico, we reached out to you, and you reached out to us, and as we did, we kept those walls tumbling down. Richard!
You're listening to some of the people who spoke at the rally on Saturday. They're now introducing Richard Trumka.
And this is more than a showdown between six fighting local unions and two companies who want to operate union free. This is a showdown between two stalking horses for all of corporate America.
Yes, some of the speakers at Saturday's rally were more than 100,000 people turned out from around the country in support of the Detroit newspaper workers. At the same time that this took place, on Friday, a judge had a favorable ruling for the workers in the strike against Detroit's daily newspapers. He ruled that the strike was caused by unfair practices. This according to a federal administrative law judge. Judge Thomas Wilkes' ruling also ordered the newspapers to reinstate all unfair labor practice strikers to their former positions of employment, displacing, if necessary, any replacement employees hired since July 13, 1995, when the 19-month strike began. Joining us right now to talk about the weekend's events, as well as this very significant NLRB ruling, is Bob Orlean, and he is a reporter with the Detroit News. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Good morning.
So what was it like this weekend?
It was a wonderful weekend. It's a great Monday morning. It's sunny here, and I think sunny in both weather as well as disposition of the people that were at the Action Motown 97, the march and rally that we held this weekend. Being a locked-out reporter for the Detroit News, I was part of the march and rally and covered it for the Detroit Sunday Journal, the strikers and locked-out workers newspaper. It was like nothing I've ever seen, that many people coming together for one single cause. And I guess you have to remember that the organizers expected 35,000 to come here for the Action Motown. That was based on the confirmed number of buses and carpools and planes and charter planes and so forth that were scheduled to arrive. We ended up with three times that many, and that's really significant, both from the standpoint of what it says to the national newspaper companies that own these newspapers, but also what it says to the labor movement, that this is an important national struggle here. And that it demands national attention, and apparently now is going to get some very serious national attention.
How significant is the judge's ruling? And also, it was a time to coincide with this massive rally.
Well, the significance is that it morally and factually validated what the workers have been saying for the last 2 years, that the company engaged in a pattern of bad faith bargaining and unlawful conduct that essentially forced this strike in 1995, when more than 2,000 people, 2,400 people actually, were forced to walk off their jobs in protest. They then resorted to the use of permanent replacements to replace the entire workforce, and are committed to holding on to those permanent replacements, most frequently called scabs by the people on strike. The ruling came down in response to a 6-month-long trial that was held last year. The government filed all sorts of unfair labor practice charges against the companies, everything ranging from failing to uphold commitments to bargain to ripping notices off union bulletin boards in the workplace. There were just a whole slew of charges of illegal conduct by the companies. And these, and after deliberating on this, after waiting 6 months after the conclusion of the hearings, Judge Wilkes found in the union's favor on the bulk of the charges. And in essence, what it does, we don't get to walk into work this morning, but it sets the groundwork. Somebody said this weekend that this was the first sentence of the last chapter of this awful ordeal in Detroit. Hmm.
Do you expect to be back to work before the end of the year?
Well, it remains to be seen. The company is vowing to appeal. They've retained lawyers from the top anti-union law firms around the country. They are formulating a legal strategy to drag this out as long as they can. And really, time is their best weapon, because as they're able to drag it out and force people to move away and drop away and even die, they are in a better position to erase these unions from their workplace.
We just have 15 seconds, but when I was out there in April covering the Labor Notes Conference and the smaller rally that took place for the striking workers, There was discussion of calling for a boycott of USA Today, which is owned by Gannett, one of the two corporations that you all are fighting against. Is that discussion continuing?
That, in fact, was discussed this weekend, and it's going to be going on. USA Today is owned by Gannett, which owns the Detroit News, and that's going to be one of our key weapons now. At hotels and airlines and airports around the country, USA Today is going to be one of the major targets of this new national campaign.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Bob Orlean, a striking Detroit news writer, one of the many people who are out there this weekend. More than 100,000 people came from around the country in support of the striking newspaper workers. Close to 2,000 of them are still out. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at the G8 summit and the other economic summit that took place there. It's called TOES. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, reading from the New York Times of this morning. It says the leaders of the eight countries that together represent about half of the world's economic activity called for rapid democratic elections in Hong Kong, renewed energy to break the stalemate in the Middle East, a new commitment to peace in Bosnia, and new aid for Africa. But in a sharp dispute with France and other European nations that dominated the morning's final session of the summit of the eight, President Clinton refused to commit the United States to a specific reduction in the emission of carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming, agreeing only to substantial reductions by the year 2010. Well, joining us right now to talk about the results of this summit, the G8 summit, and also their own summit, the other economic summit that took place in Denver this weekend, are three people who have joined thousands of others who came from around the world to talk about alternative economics. We're joined by Cillian Park, who is with the Colorado Progressive Coalition. We're also joined by Mark Harrison of the United Methodist Board of Church and Society and Mike Dolan of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Cillian Park, why don't we begin with you? Can you tell us first about this summit that took place of your own, the People's Summit, the other economic summit, and then what your reaction is to the conclusion of the G8 summit?
Sure. The People's Summit 97, held in Denver, alternative to the Denver Summit of the Eight, was really huge, just huge. There were over 100 events. Around 5,000 people joined us from the beginning of this week with the Indigenous Peoples Tribunal. Through Sunday, we are represented by over 32 nations. I think one of the exciting things was we were discussing the problems, the solutions, how to implement these alternatives, and many different communities that don't normally work together came together for this. So what we saw was a lot of cross-issue solidarity, union members working with gay and lesbian community, working with women's groups. What we hope to develop is some long-term relationships to really hold the G8 or the Summit of Eight accountable. Their communique, completely corporate-driven agenda. What we need to do is make sure that people's voices do get heard. What we're focusing on now, coming out of the People's Summit, is where do we go from here? This was a great weekend. This was a great week of events, lots of education and information. What do we do with it? We need to take this information and take action in the streets, write to your congresspeople, start going into the media, and really really being proactive and building a broad-based people's movement to hold the G8 countries accountable.
Mike Dolan of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, can you talk from your perspective as a national lobbying and research group in Washington, D.C., about the conclusions of the G8 summit that was happening where you were? I mean, nothing is binding, of course. They sit around a table and they talk about various issues. And what is your thoughts on this?
Well, as like a lot of people still here in Denver, yesterday afternoon I went and picked up a copy of the communique which the G7 plus Russia issued yesterday afternoon. And just going through it, I just noticed a tremendous level of internal inconsistency in the communique. There's a lot of lip service, frankly, being paid to concepts like sustainable development. And it's in there, but as you look at this document more closely, you realize that this is basically a document which implies a corporate bill of rights, and that the constant references to open markets for trade and investment really is a corporate bill of rights, and that the agenda, as well as the communique, is being driven by those corporate interests. And as you look back over the weekend, and I have to tell you, it was Soyun is exactly right that there is a difference between the sort of the corporate and political leaders on the one side and the people summit on the other. There are literally concrete barriers around the G8 and the white men in the inside and the rest of us on the outside. Very, very stark contrast in Denver this weekend. Of the four basic sort of competing interests in political economy today, labor, government, business, and investment community, this is clearly the business community and the investment community that has won, that is the victor this weekend. I think probably the most egregious oversight this weekend or failing of the conference is, as you pointed out, the failure of the governments to set enforceable mandatory emissions control limits on the issue of global warming. Also, I would have to say that President Clinton's backtracking on issues relating to China human rights is very, very unfortunate. It's sort of what we expected, but as Soyun Park has just pointed out, we do have a really great opportunity to pick up from the energy of the other economic summit and the People's Summit here and to work together in anticipation of developing those sort of alternative economics that the mainstream media and the official source media don't talk about.
I think it's interesting that this row develops also at the same time in the front page piece in the New York Times yesterday. Environmental groups say Gore has not measured up to the job.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let me bring Mark Harrison into this conversation. Mark Harrison of United Methodist Board of Church and Society, also involved with the 50 Years is Enough campaign. The communique that was issued yesterday also talked about support for Clinton's initiative to help African countries by opening markets and reducing duties. But the Europeans also insisted that market access and capitalism could not replace direct aid. And the French and Japanese agreed to work together on their own aid and investment initiative in Africa. President of France, Jacques Chirac, said he was glad Washington was now thinking about Africa, while Chancellor Helmut Kohl of Germany, speaking sarcastically, said he welcomed America's discovery of Africa. What are your comments on the issue of the G8 and their approach to Africa?
One of the things that we found that was of interest was that in the last part of the 19th century, around, I think it was 1884, 1885, they had the Berlin Conference. And that was when the European powers came together to divide up Africa among themselves. This time they had a major discussion on Africa, and the African leadership or African NGOs were not nowhere to be found, and whether we're not invited be part of the discussion to lay out their plans. And that was a great disturbing to us. One thing that happened during this summit was there was a great deal of U.S. boasting about how great our economy was, and we had to show and we had to respond to that. And I think that affected the conference in the sense of here the U.S. was coming up with this African initiative, And basically the Europeans and the Japanese, in many ways, were poo-pooing it because one, they said, we're already doing this. This doesn't go far enough. And from our perspective, our concern was that it was tying Africa development to the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF. There were too many conditionalities on the U.S. program with those countries who could benefit. So that was a grave concern for us. And
when you talk about structural adjustment, I mean, these are common words that are thrown around at the alternative summits, particularly 50 Years is Enough campaign, starting with the idea that 50 years of the World Bank and IMF is enough and they should be abolished. But explain what you mean when you say structural adjustment.
Well, basically, the World Bank, and particularly led by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, will negotiate supposedly with governments who have serious what they call balance of trade problems. They are having the economies are down, and they come up with a plan to help these countries, quote, stabilize their economies. And what these plans usually do is say you must cut back on subsidies, and many times these subsidies are help the poor in a country. You must cut back on your budget. This is education. It can also affect health care. So we found that these structural adjustment programs hurt the poor, and that and they haven't done that well for Africa. So that is why we have taken a strong position against the structural adjustment program. But I just want to add, at this summit, the religious working group on the World Bank and IMF, a coalition of different Protestant and Catholic groups, announced the Jubilee 2000 campaign. That is a worldwide campaign to bring definitive debt relief for impoverished countries by the year 2000. And we're going to be starting a petition drive throughout the United States, as well as other countries, to start the new millennium with getting rid of debt and a new Jubilee for the new millennium.
You know, it always strikes me as odd that in this country there was protectionism for 200 years to get industry in the United States going to support them before opening up the markets. And here you have countries that are, you know, just getting on their feet, and the U.S. is demanding that the only way that they'll push to get, you know, their loans forgiven is if they immediately open up their markets. We've seen what is happening with this in countries like Haiti, and now you're talking about Africa.
Yes, and it was very of interest that the European countries took a different view on that. They wanted, they didn't want any conditionalities that you had to do this, this, and this in order to benefit from the program. That's where they disagreed with the United States was on that. And as someone who's, quote, studied economics, Amy, I agree with you. That's what we study, that as long as you have an infant industry, you have to protect that industry. And they keep talking about the Asian tigers of Singapore and South Korea and so forth. But they also protected their industry, and they also had a active government who was investing in the economy and in education programs. So this is something that this is in direct opposition to what the United States says it should be done.
Mike Dolan of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, what is the multilateral agreement on investments?
I'm glad you asked that. It's actually one of the main reasons I wanted to come out here to Denver this weekend, is to raise some public awareness and some perhaps create some political accountability around this stealth treaty that's being negotiated in Paris, France, even now. It's in an organization called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is a 29-country member club, the richest countries, the G7 countries obviously being the leadership within the OECD. It is nothing less than a complete corporate bill of rights. It picks up where the WTO and NAFTA and GATT, left off in terms of granting tremendous new rights to investors for capital mobility, direct foreign investment. It essentially is a treaty which will undermine or invalidate all laws or domestic ordinances, local provisions that favor local ownership over absentee ownership. At Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, we call it sort of GAFTA on steroids. And it contains a very, very new and very interesting and very dangerous provision called investor-to-state dispute resolution, whereby individual corporations and investors can sue countries under the provisions, the very extreme provisions of this agreement. And I guess I'll just say by way of conclusion about this, because I'm sure many of your listeners have not heard about the MAI yet, because it's been really negotiated in secret. It's almost nearly done, the negotiations. And yet the governments that are negotiating these provisions are simply not telling their people and their representatives and the mainstream press about these negotiations. And Public Citizen, along with a group in Washington called the Preamble Collaborative for Public Policy, have accepted the challenge and the responsibility to broadcast and raise political education, raise public education about these proceedings before this thing comes back to the United States as a full-blown treaty. It's a very dangerous, very stealth negotiations. It's a very dangerous treaty, and I encourage your listeners to stay tuned and to ask their own representatives what they know about the MAI.
You know, it's interesting that conservative members of Congress also push very hard. I mean, the corporate Republicans and Democrats all push hard for these kind of international agreements. And yet this really is a challenge to the sovereignty of the United States.
Absolutely right. It is an issue, Amy, which cuts across partisan lines. Like so much in trade policy, that there are conservative Republicans who agree with progressive Democrats about the lurking danger of these kinds of multilateral trade agreements. Well, this MAI, this new one, is as dangerous as NAFTA and GATT put together. And if there are questions about the sovereignty of local laws, community reinvestment acts, living wage campaigns, environmental, local land use kinds of laws, all of these are on the are in jeopardy because of the MAI, and the coalition that is developing in opposition to this MAI treaty, as it runs the ideological spectrum.
If people want to get more information on the multilateral agreement on investments, where can they call, Mike?
Sure, that'd be fine. They can call the following number and get a recording. And then we will send some materials out, and that number is 202-588-7777. And you'll hear my voice, and then you'll leave your name and number and address, and I'm going to send you some materials and hope that people will want to learn more about this stealth treaty, because we'd be happy to share what we've learned so far.
That's
in spite of the secrecy of the negotiations.
That's 202-588-7777 in Swain Park of the Colorado Progressive Coalition. If people want to get involved with this ongoing movement of the People's Summit and the other economic summit, where can they get more information on the web and perhaps a phone number? We just have about 15 seconds.
To reach the Colorado Progressive Coalition, it's 303-866-0908. And we can put you in touch with TOES and other folks that are working on different issues.
That's 303-866-0908. And Mark Harrison of the United Methodist Board of Church and Society, for your work on Africa, how can people find out more information?
I would suggest that people call the Washington Office on Africa at 202-546-7961.
That's 202-546-7961. I want to thank you all for joining us from Denver, Soyen Park, Mark Harrison, and Mike Dolan. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to send us some email, you can send it to us at democracy@pacifica.org. We're also online. You can hear the show by just going to our website, pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York, our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Thanks to Zachary Fink. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
$99.5